So today and probably the first half of next time, we're going to spend on converse theorems. Now these are global results. So K is again a global field, which we've taken to be a number field, but that is not essential. As I said, everything that I will present here is perfectly valid over function fields. The formulation is just not quite the right one you would want over function fields. A, the ring of Adels. Although it is true, if you want the converse theorem in a formulation that is correct for function fields, then you'll find such in an appendix to Laforgue's paper, because he needs it for function fields. A, the Adels, psi, added a character. Huh? Part of his proof. There's an induction involved. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Always has been. I mean, there was an old, it's one of these reductions. You have to go back and forth between Galois representations and automorphic representations. And you know a fair amount about the Galois representations in the function field case. And so it was always known, old stuff of Deligne and PS from the 70s, that if you could prove it in one direction using trace formula, you got the other direction for free using converse theorem. And so they sort of bootstrap your way up using these two things. So, yeah, so it's converse theorem's part of Laforgue's proof of global Langlands, but that part of it's been around for a while. So anyway, so yes, he needed it. And he needed it in a rational function form as opposed to the analytic function form that I'm going to give you. Okay, so let me take pi. This is going to be an irreducible, admissible, smooth representation of GLN over the Adels. Okay. Now the point is that this is just an abstract representation. Okay. It is irreducible, so it does have a factorization. It is not automorphic necessarily. Okay. So in some sense, you can think of the converse theorem as answering the following question: how can you tell if these local pieces are coherent enough to give an embedding, well, not to give, but so that you have an embedding of the space of pi into the space of smooth automorphic forms, and let's say cuspidal. Okay, because really, this invariance by GLNK can be thought of as a coherence condition on all of, since that sits in diagonally, you can think of that invariance as sort of forcing a coherence on these local components. Okay, so that's one way to think about the converse theorem. It doesn't quite look like the classical ones there. So let me show you a way to think about it in terms of the classical ones. So I'm going to answer this question, or give an answer to it. The answer is going to be analytic, and it's going to involve L functions. Okay? And so the first thing to note is that from the factorization, which is an abstract fact, into this restricted tensor product, to each local piece, then by the local theory that we've done, both non-Archimedean and Archimedean, and that once you were doing the local theory, there was nothing that said this has to be a component of a cusp form. Okay? The things that we used, sort of the integrals and the various things, the functional equation that we knew we wanted, came from the global theory, but once we were local, we never used anything about it being a component of a cusp form. So for each local representation, we do indeed have local L and epsilon factors. Right? So we have an LS pi V and an epsilon S pi V psi V. And so we can formally form an L function attached to pi just as the Euler product defined out of the local factors, and similarly an epsilon factor which is formed by the product of the local epsilon factors. And then if you want, you can rephrase this question to be, is this formal L function, or if you multiply it out, it's a Dirichlet series. Modular. That is associated to an automorphic form. This looks much more like the classical converse theorems of Heck and Vey. They started with a Dirichlet series and they said, does it come from a modular form? Here I've given you a Dirichlet series as a formal Euler product. Okay? And I've given you sort of a description of it in the sense that to each Euler factor I've attached a representation somehow. That's the way I've described it. Okay? But in this formulation, you can think of this as being a formal Euler product or a formal Dirichlet series, and we're asking, does it come from a modular form? Okay. Now, for this to even make sense, we need to impose certain mild coherence and automorphy conditions. I mean, even in the theorem of Hecke, he assumed that he had a Dirichlet series that converged, right? So the first thing we need to assume is that LS pi, this Euler product, converges for the real part of S sufficiently large. Okay, that's a coherence. That's telling you, I mean, you know that this is a representation of the Adels. That's a restricted tensor product, or restricted product of groups. This, to be an irreducible admissible representation, the local components here are unramified almost everywhere. And so this, in some sense, this condition is a condition that those unramified components don't grow to, the parameters in there don't grow too quickly. Okay? So this is a mild coherence condition. It's telling you something about the local components. And the second condition is that I want the central character of this representation to actually be an automorphic form on GL1. So the central character omega pi of this representation is an automorphic form on GL1. I.e., it's an Edel class character. So it's invariant under the rational points. Okay? That's a mild automorphy condition. And one reason why this is important. Now, I'm going to put this as a note, although we can note it from things that I've told you, but not anything that I've actually proven, that the second condition implies that the epsilon factor is actually independent of the additive character. Okay? Now, actually, when we talked about this, I guess it was last week, and about the global epsilon factor, we formed this product, and I told you there were two ways to tell if pi was automorphic, at least, that the epsilon factor didn't depend on the additive character. One of them was, you see locally how it depends on the additive character. And I told you that it spits out the central character evaluated somewhere. and that if you then took the product, it was evaluated at a rational point, and the central character was automorphic, so the dependence on psi went away. That's what you do here. The same thing's going to happen. You look at how the local pieces vary if you change this additive character. It spits out the central character evaluated somewhere, and if the central character evaluated at a rational point, and if the central character is automorphic, that means there is no dependence on psi, and you don't want there to be one. So that's what that condition is there for. Okay? It gives you this independence. Okay. Now, under these conditions, if we take pi prime to be any cuspidal representation, so automorphic, so hence automorphic, of, say, a smaller general linear group, so let's say n between 1 and n minus 1, then we can form twisted L and epsilon factors. So I can form, say, LS pi times pi prime is, again, first formally as a formal Euler product. That makes sense. And a twisted epsilon factor okay. And so I put mild coherence conditions on pi. Pi prime is cuspidal, so that's about as coherent as one could want. And so it's not very hard to show that under conditions 1 and 2, we have that L S pi times pi prime converges absolutely for the real part of S sufficiently large, and the twisted epsilon factor also is independent of pi prime. Okay. So that shouldn't be too hard to believe. Notice that I could also do the same thing. I could draw the same conclusions for the contragredients. Okay. I mean, if pi, these mild conditions on pi is going to tell me that the L function for the contragredient converges as well, and the twisted L function converges as well. Okay. So I could do the same thing for the contragredient. And now we will say that these twisted L functions are nice if they behave as they would if we knew pi was cuspidal. So if pi were indeed cuspidal, i.e., three things. First, Ls pi times pi prime and Ls pi tittle pi contragredient twisted by the contragredient pi prime extend to entire functions. Of S. So we proved that last time. If pi is cuspidal, right, this is a result. These are bounded in vertical strips. And they satisfy the standard functional equation, which is the one that we proved last time, assuming L was cuspidal, that LS pi prime is equal to epsilon S pi twisted by pi prime L 1 minus S pi contragradient twisted by pi prime contragradient. Okay? So that's what nice is going to mean. And our converse theorem, much like Vase, is going to involve these twists. Okay? Vase converse theorem involved was a converse theorem for GL2 that involved twists by characters on GL1. And here we're going to wind up twisting by, right now we have to twist by more things. No, he does not. No, he does not. It's a, well, yes and no. I mean, but yes, it is. Yes, this is an Euler product theorem. This is definitely an Euler product theorem. Yeah. Yes, theirs is an Euler product. So there is, yes, there is kind of a difference here. But from this, from the point of view of automorphic representations, this is sort of the natural theorem. If I just start with the Dirichlet series, and my tool, right, is automorphic representations, and those L functions come with Euler products. If I don't have an Euler product, I'm dead in the water to begin with. So it's the analog, I mean, in some sense, it's an analog of their theorem in the sense that last time I showed what happened, I proved the basic analytic properties of cuspidal automorphic representations. Right? And now what I'm doing is I'm trying to prove the converse to that theorem in the sense that if I have appropriate looking L functions, or in this formulation, if I have a representation, which is not necessarily automorphic, but its L function behaves as if it was, then that should be automorphic. So it's a converse sort of to the global properties of the L function. But the point I'm making here is just that they require twists, and we will require twists. Okay. And now, let me, since we are going to require these twists, let me introduce a little bit of notation. So let me set T of M. What this is going to be the disjoint union, say D equals 1 up to M, of the set of all pi prime, where pi prime is a cuspidal representation of GLD. So in other words, this is all cuspidal representations from GL1 up to GLM. And if S is a finite set of finite places, I'm going to let T's for twisting, upper S of M, to be the set of all pi prime in this twisting set, such that locally this is unramified for the places in S. Okay, so that's all the notation that I need. And then the theorem, let's see, what do I want to erase? Since I'm answering those two questions, I'll put one theorem here and one theorem there. So here's a couple of things that we're able to prove right now. So here's the first version of the converse theorem that I want to tell you about. This is sort of the bread and butter version. This is, in some sense, the analog of A. It says, suppose pi is as above, What did I say? No, that's exactly what I want. Yeah, this is what I want. So there is a version. We do have a level one version where I fix a finite set of places and I allow my twist to be unramified outside S. Okay? That we don't have any applications for that one yet. The one that's used in all of these new functorialities is this one. Okay? And so the ones I'm going to talk about are the ones with this twisting set. Okay? So as above means irreducible, admissible, smooth. The ELF function converges for real part of S large enough, and the central character is automorphic. So it means all of that. Suppose that the twisted ELF functions are nice for all pi prime in this twisting set, where twists up to n minus 1. Okay? So this is, since they had a GL2 twisting by GL1, this is sort of the analog of that. Then there are two conclusions. The first one is that if S is empty, okay, so you're twisting by everything, then this is up to, because this set, right, this set says it's everything starting from 1 up to M. So if S is empty, then pi is cuspidal representation of GLN. Okay. So it answers, this is one answer to this question. If the L function behaves like it would, if pi was cuspidal, then pi is cuspidal. Okay, which means the space embeds into here. Or if the L function has all the nice properties, it is modular. Second condition says that if S is not empty, okay, that means I'm twisting by, at these places I'm twisting by less because my twisting representations are unramified there. That's a condition. Then all we can say is that pi is quasi automorphic. Or you might say nearly automorphic or weakly automorphic. Doesn't matter. This, for some reason, this is what we called it. And what this means is that there exists an automorphic representation, pi 1 of GLN, such that locally this representation, pi 1v, looks like pi v, at least for all places where you've done full twisting, okay? So for all v not in S. So I lose any control I might have had at the places in S where I've restricted my twists. I also lose cuspidality, but it turns out since I'm going to use this to lift representations from one place to another, this is going to be where I'm going to get my image representation. And even if I start with something cuspidal, there's nothing that says my image has to be cuspidal. So this flexibility is actually good. It's built in there for a reason. Okay? It looks like a weakness, but it's not. It's a strength, actually, being able to do this. If S is in, sure. What do you mean? No. This is unramified for V and S. If S is empty, this is, says nothing. This is this. This is this. No conditions. No conditions. No conditions. And then the second theorem. So this one, hopefully today, I will sketch the proof of this. Okay, I'll give you all the ideas in the proof of this. So we're going to more or less prove this today, I hope. And now the second theorem, which is stronger, but the proof is a slightly more subtle, is the following. And let me just give you the abbreviated version of it. Okay. So it says pi is above. And now we suppose LS pi twisted by pi prime is nice for pi prime. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to twist up to n minus 2. So first off, I always forget this condition. N has to be bigger than or equal to 3 for this theorem. I'm not claiming a theorem without any twists whatsoever in the GL2 case. So for GL3, this says I'm twisting by characters. For GL4, it says I can twist it by GL1 and GL2. Okay? Then exactly the same conclusions. So if S is empty, I prove that pi is cuspidal. If S is not empty, so I have some restrictions on my twists, I prove that there is an automorphic thing that agrees with what I started with at all places except those. Okay? And I will at least try to give you an idea of the differences, what you have to do extra to get this from there. Okay? It's really, the idea is, for the first two-thirds of the proof are exactly the same, and then you have to do something extra at the end, because just like in the case where you're twisting, where you're leaving out some places here, which means you haven't twisted by everything, here you've twisted by something, things of lower rank, so you also haven't twisted by everything, so you have to sort of somehow work around that. Mm-hmm. Ask me again midway through next lecture. Okay, because that'll be much easier to explain once I've gone through the proofs of these, I think. Okay? And I'll explain why we're having trouble getting there, and I'll also explain why I see very little difference between n over 2 and 1. But that's just from a technical point of view. But yeah, I'll talk about those conjectures at the very end, which means middle of next lecture. Okay, so the first thing I want to do is I want to sketch the proof of theorem 1. And now I'm going to begin by making a simplifying assumption. So I'm going to assume that pi is generic. Okay, we've talked about how to get around this. If pi is not generic, I write it as the Langlands quotient of something, and each one of those induced has a full Whitaker model, and every place I use a Whitaker model here, I use the Whitaker model for that induced. Okay, so we've sort of talked about what we do if the representation is not generic, and that's same thing goes here. If it's not generic, there's a way to get around it, but the idea is, or you all see in the generic case. So we're going to assume that pi is generic, okay? But it's really just for simplicity. Okay. So, all right. Let me put this time I'll put the theorem up. And let's see what we can do about the proof. Okay. Well, in some sense, the bread and butter part of the proof. I haven't been numbering things, have I? Oh, it doesn't matter. Okay. Is we're going to do exactly what Hecke did. We're going to invert the integral representation. That's the way Hecke and Wey proved their converse theorems. They inverted an integral representation, and that's what we will do here. So the main step is inverting the integral representation, which means all the theory that we've been talking about for the last few weeks. Okay? So if even if you wanted to just know about the converse theorem, you would have to know about all the things that we've been doing. Okay? So that's why this is coming so late in the game. We will, as you'll see, we'll need most of the things that we've proven. Okay. The first thing I need, I have an abstract representation. I'm claiming that I'm getting and embedding into automorphic forms. The first thing I need is functions on the group somehow. Okay? That's what generic gives me. Okay? So we need to construct some functions on the group. Okay? Generic lets us do this. So I'm going to take C and V pi. Now remember, V pi decomposes. Okay? And I want to take C such that in this decomposition, C decomposes. Okay? So I want to take a decomposable vector. Otherwise, it's arbitrary. Okay? Everything's a finite linear combination of these. And now to each CV, right, this is now just local. This is a local generic representation. I have a Whitaker function. Okay? Because they're generic. And so to C, I attach a global Whitaker function, which is simply now the product of these local Whitaker functions. I don't have to worry about a global Whitaker function that's defined in any other way, because before we had something that was defined by an unipotent integral of a cusp form, and I don't have any such thing. So I just take the local ones and I take the product. Okay, local estimates say this is fine. You can do this. There's no question about convergence. Okay, and this is a smooth function on, well, I now have a function on GLNA, and it's invariant under, well, what do I know? I know that on the left, this translates under the unipotent radical by my additive character. My additive character, that wasn't a Del class character. It's invariant under the rational points. So this is still invariant under at least the rational points of the translations. Okay? So I got a function on the group, and I've got at least that it's invariant under something. Okay. Now, the crudest thing that one could try to do here is say, well, all I do is average it all the way up to GLN. I just sum this thing over GLNK mod NNK. And that would be perfectly fine, except for the fact that it does not converge. So that you can't do. But what we're going to do is we're going to average this as much as possible and still have convergence. So still get a sum that converges. And how do you tell whether it converges? Well, I'm summing Whitaker functions, and we had all these old local estimates on Whitaker functions that I told you about, the way that they behaved. This is just a product of those, and we're using those estimates to tell whether something converges or not. So how much can you possibly sum over? You can sum over the mirabolic. Remember, this was P, it was the stabilizer, and GLN of this vector. In matrices, it looked like the last row was that. That's the mirabolic. And so we form U, C of G, it's just the sum over P in. So I'm already invariant under the translations. Now I sum over the mirabolic, WxCpg. And just as before, now we're back in early lectures, Mirabolic mod the unipotent radical is the same thing as GLN minus 1 modulo its unipotent radical. So this is the same as the sum gamma in N, N minus 1 K mod GL N minus 1 K WC gamma 1 G. And if you forget everything above it, and you just look at this expression, you're supposed to say, I know what that is. That's the Fourier expansion of a cusp form. Okay? So if this was a cusp form, if I started off with a cusp form instead of just a vector, this is its Fourier expansion. Okay? So this is the analog of Hecker-Weyse's first step. They take a Dirichlet series, they pull off its coefficients, and they form a formal Fourier expansion from it. That's what I've done. That's my formal Fourier expansion formed from my, well, it would be my L function in their case. Here it's formed from this set of local data. I mean, you can just think of that as a collection of local data that gives me a local Euler product. Okay, there it is. And what can you prove about this? What can you say about this? Well, here's a little proposition. Now, two parts of it are little. The third part of it's actually a little bit pesky, but we're going to avoid the pesky part. So here's a proposition. So this sum, the sum defining this function u of xi, converges absolutely and uniformly on compact subsets. So it's a reasonable function of G. By construction, it is left invariant by the rational points of the Mirabolic. So not enough to make it automorphic yet, but it's something. And then the pesky part, which is the proof of this is a little bit delicate, and so I won't go into that, is that if I restrict this to GLN minus 1 in the upper left-hand corner, it's rapidly decreasing, at least modulo the center. And the restriction. So let's say peak C H1 to HN. Now, this is going to be in GLN minus 1A, but the rational points of this, right, the rational points of the GLN minus 1 are sitting up here in this block of the Mirabolic, so it's actually invariant under GLN minus 1K. Is, in fact, rapidly decreasing. And let's just say mod the center. Okay. Much like a cusp form on GLN is. It's not rapidly decreasing because it's got some growth along the center, but once you get rid of that, it's rapidly decreasing. Right? That was sort of the rapid, so it's like what you have for cusp forms. And this is actually, like I said, this is pesky, but that's okay. All right, so that's my guy. Now, just as in the classical case, we're going to have to use the functional equation to get the extra invariance out somehow. And so I need something on the other side of the functional equation. And the point, just for where we're sitting right now, is that really there's nothing special about this Mirabolic. We could have done this for any Mirabolic whatsoever, which means stabilizer of a vector. Okay? So to utilize, and this, I mean, we see this a little bit later, the functional equation. No, this is just analyzing. This is there's no L functions here. This is just analyzing. Yeah. Well, it comes from this expansion. What I'm saying is this looks like the Fourier expansion of a cusp form, right? So it says I take something and I've chopped off. Basically, it says you take something like a classical sum, right? You chop off its first term, right, the constant term, and the rest of the sum is the sum of exponentials, right? And those, that's nice. That's sort of what this is. Basically, yeah, because see, this, like I said, this looks like the Fourier expansion of a cusp form. Okay? Yeah, it's this. It's the restriction of this sum. Yeah, so that's like, it's like I've chopped, classically, it's like I've chopped off any, constant terms that I would have had. Yeah, so it's like, it's pesky. It's not. Well, I mean, yeah. But yeah, it's good luck checking it. it's a little bit more than a check. It's pesky. Yeah. So anyway, but that's the idea. Well, no, I mean, it's just the fact you should think of this as a sum of negative exponentials. Yeah, no. This is like having the non-constant terms. That does look like the Fourier expansion of a cusp form. Okay. We just do this for a second parabolic. And the one that you use, you actually sort of have to, you know, work backwards to see what you need. And so the one we're going to use in this case is the opposite parabolic. So it's going to be the stabilizer in GLN of this row vector, which means it has the form Q equals 0, 0 down to 1. So it's that parabolic. Okay? Now, I want to sum the Whitaker function on that. Here, for P, I had the luxury that the natural unipotent radical set inside here. Here, the maximal, my standard unipotent radical that I'm Whitaker with respect to does not sit inside here, so I have to twist things a little bit. So I take here's a permutation matrix. So let me take this. Okay. Because when I average, I want to use the fact that I already have some invariance here. And then we form something that I call B. And this is going to be the sum over Q in the rational point of this parabolic modulo what I'm going to call N prime, WC, and it's got alpha Q. Save me. What am I doing? G. And this N prime is simply alpha inverse usual translation group alpha. Okay, that turns out is a subgroup of Q. You have to check that. But that's the deal. And this, again, converges uniformly on compact sets. It is, what was the other one? Invariant. What am I doing? That I'm restricting that function. I don't know what that other thing I had written up there meant. Converges uniformly on compact sets. It's invariant under the rational points of this parabolic. And again, it's rapidly decreasing again mod center on GLN minus 1. Right. And that upper triangular, that upper GLN minus 1 sits in this as, I mean, sits in Q. Okay. Now the point is to note that together Q and P, these two mirabolics, P and its opposite, generate GLN, the rational points of GLN. Okay? So if we can show that these two functions are equal, okay, if I can show these two things are equal, then from this realization, it's invariant under the mirabolic. From this realization, it's invariant under the opposite mirabolic. So it's invariant under all of GL and K. And that's essentially what I'm looking for. Then, as it turns out, this map, C goes to U, C, G, will embed the space of pi into the space of cuspidal automorphic forms on GLN. Okay, so that's what we want, is this equality. And that's what's going to come out of the integral representation. Okay? Okay, so that's the setup. So, well, we use the integral representation. We haven't used anything about L functions yet, now we do. Okay? So I'm going to use the integral representation for GLN twisted by GLN minus 1. Okay. Now, I'm going to twist. Remember, I'm going to invert this single integral representation, but I've assumed twisting by a bunch of things. Okay? Cus forms on all lower GLs. Now, you'll see why I did that in a minute, but what I'm going to say right now is a little bit different from what we've done. I now want to take pi prime automorphic of GLN minus 1A such that the space of pi prime is actually a subset of the space of automorphic forms on GLN minus 1. Okay. These, we call these proper. Okay. What they are is, remember, an automorphic representation in general is a subquotient of the space of automorphic forms. Once I take a subquotient, I really don't have a model for this representation. I don't know that it's made of automorphic forms anymore. These proper ones are the ones which you really have a model as automorphic forms. Okay? It's an honest space of automorphic forms. Now, these include cuspidal things, right? They also include Eisenstein series. Spaces of Eisenstein series, right? Because you form an Eisenstein series, that's an automorphic form. So it contains all of those. Okay? Just doesn't, you're not allowed to take residues of Eisenstein series, basically. Because that gives you a quotient. Okay? So we're going to use these. And then for every we're going to take one of these automorphic forms. I form my usual global integral. So where shall I write it? I guess I'll come over here and erase another board. Actually, there's no way I'm going to get to that theorem today, so I'll using that board as well. Well, I form my usual integral. So it's GLn minus 1a mod GLn minus 1k. Uc restricted to h1, phi prime h, absolute determinant h to the s minus a half dh. Okay? Now, that thing, all I know about that is it's an automorphic form, it's moderate growth. But this thing, proposition tells me that the thing I'm integrating against, uc restricted there, is rapidly decreasing. Okay? So that thing converges up to whatever the determinant's doing. I don't have much control on the determinant. I do have a mild determinant estimate in this proposition that I didn't put up there. And so this actually converges for the real part of S sufficiently large. And it just comes from a determinant estimate on this piece. The SL part, the mod center part, is rapidly decreasing. So I get that. And now once I have that, what do? Well, I unfold it just like before. Right? From this point on, I can sort of work, not formally, but like I did when I had my global integrals. Right? I replaced this by its Fourier expansion. I've got that. That was built in. I just erased it. It's right there. I unfold. I do the integral here, and I get a Whitaker model here. Okay? So this is equal to what we call psi of S WC, W of phi prime, okay, just as before, okay. So this, let me, since I do have at least one new person. So this is this integral, just to remind people. It's the same integral replaced by the Whitaker functionals. Okay. And now if I take t as a finite set of places, containing the Archimedean places, such that pi v, pi prime v, and psi v are unramified for v not in t, well, oops, I've gotten one step ahead of myself because I wrote that integral. I got one step ahead of myself. What did we need to factor this integral before into local products? Well, we just needed that the two Whitaker functions factored, and that hasn't changed. So this, the first thing we do is we factor it into a product over all places of the corresponding local integrals. Okay? Now, for the places outside of T, I've got unramified guys. Okay? Unramified generic guys. I've done that local calculation. That gives me the L function. Oh, I should stop. I always do this. So everything to here is fine. Everything to here is fine. This is purely formal. Now let me assume for a moment that pi prime is cuspidal. I probably should have done this way back up there. Let me see. Where did I want to do this? No, this is where I wanted to do it. Okay. Let me assume that pi prime is cuspidal, okay? Because that's really where I've done the calculations. If pi prime is cuspidal and I've got this finite set of places, then at the places not in T, I've done the unramified calculation, and I know what it gives, right? It gives me, well, so I got prompt V and T. That's where I'm not going to do anything just yet. And then I get the partial L function. Okay. Which then, right, if I want to complete it, I just divide this by the corresponding factors. And I denoted those ratios by E. And I get this expression. Okay, this is the same expression that I had before when I was trying to read the properties of this function off from the properties of the global integrals. Well, now I'm doing the opposite. What do I know? I know this converges in a half plane. By assumption, this is entire. That's one of the inputs to the converse theorem. This is entire by assumption. This is a finite product of those local pieces. These are entire because we more or less proved it. At least I told you we could prove it. Okay? So this is entire. So this says, UC V prime extends to an entire function of S. Okay? Now, are we okay? I mean, hopefully we're okay here. What we did last week, I'm just now doing it backwards. I really am inverting the process. Okay. Now, what happens if pi prime is not cuspidal? Then I haven't assumed anything about this, right? This is just some Euler product. What we use is the following. So remember at the end of last time I told you about a theorem of Langlands that says any automorphic is a constituent of an induced from cuspidal. Okay? In this case, what happens if pi prime is not cuspidal, then by Langlands, there exists cuspidal representations. I'll call them tau I of GLNI, such that, and this is what I'm going to tell you is a little bit more than what's in Langlands, but you prove it exactly the same way, is that this space, which is a space of automorphic forms, is really a subspace of this induced from cuspidal. All right? So it actually turns out, if this is a subspace of the space of automorphic forms, then you can realize it as a subspace of one of these induced from cuspidals. Okay? And now you have to do some analysis here and see what the theory of local integrals looks like. This basically says this thing has a Whitaker model. This sits as a sub. So the Whitaker model of this you get by restricting the Whitaker model of this. It's the Whitaker model of this that's occurred in all of my integrals. And so you have to do some work. I mean, this has gone a little bit, I'm going a little bit beyond what we've done up here, because I'm talking about what happens if I have something that's not cuspidal. And what one shows, so that means you have to do a little work, is that in this case, IS UC phi prime is equal to something, which is entire, times LS pi twisted by tau 1, LS pi twisted by tau r. This, it turns out, you can show is still entire. And these are entire by assumption because this is pi twisted by cus forms on smaller GLs. So this is where I'm using the cus forms on all, the twisting by cus forms on smaller GLs to gain control over my global integrals where this is a proper automorphic form but possibly not cuspidal. Okay? So there is a little bit, if not, this is not a hard thing. It's just beyond what I've talked about. But this is the idea. You use this theorem of Langlands to reduce to cusp forms on smaller things. And so this still entire. Okay. All right. So that's that. Now, let's see, I want to keep that. Now that I'm erasing V, we do exactly the same thing with V now. So I form I of S V C phi prime, so this is the integral, GLn minus 1a mod GLn minus 1k, Vxc H1, phi prime H, determinant H to the S minus a half, dH. Now, convergence, well, if you think about what I told you up there, I said, well, on SL, there's no problem because this guy's rapidly decreasing, and then I had some estimate on the determinant that gave me increasing in the right half plane. Here, the same thing more or less happens. I'm rapidly decreasing on SL, so that's not a problem. The determinant estimate is sort of in the other direction. So this actually converges for the real part of S, very small. Okay? I haven't told you. I mean, I just told you that that's true. I haven't really given you the reason. It's because of this further estimates on U and C. Okay. And down there, it unfolds. And here's the secret part that went into the construction of this function C. When you unfold this, you get the following. You get the product V and T. So, same work here. You get, well, you ought to be able to guess what you get. It's not necessarily an easy thing to show, but you get the other side of the functional equation. I mean, it's just, it's should be amazing, but really it's just a nice long messy calculation. Huh? Yeah, you basically do the same thing. Okay? But now it's not this integral when you stick this in, okay, when you stick this in, you replace it by that sum over Q, it's not exactly an integral that you've seen before. And so you go through the same process that you did to unfold that and see what these local pieces are. Okay? And when you get down to here, you're getting these local pieces. Now, at the unramified places, that's going to compute the L function for you again. And at the ramified places, you just divide by the L function. So going from here to here is a messy calculation. Okay? So this is pure calculation right now. I mean, you just do it and that's what you get. And in some sense, this was constructed so that that would happen. Right? I never justified that choice of Mirabolic. This is the justification. Okay? This is S is empty. Yeah, we're doing number one. S is empty now. Yeah, S is empty. But it hasn't played a role yet. In some sense, it hasn't played a role yet. That's right, it hasn't played a role yet. So this tells me that this extends to an entire function. And of course, this is what I've written here is if pi prime is cuspidal. If it's not cuspidal, then I get an expression like this using the cusp forms on the smaller group. Okay? So now I know, okay, so what am I trying to do? I'm trying to show that these two functions are equal, and what I've shown is that, well, I haven't shown anything. What I've shown is I can write down that integral in its entire, and I can write down that integral in its entire. But what do we know? Well, we know that this is related, if pi prime's cuspidal, these two things are related by the global functional equation. Right? And this is related to this by the local functional equation. Okay? So that is equal to this times epsilon. Right? That's the global functional equation. And if you go back and you look at the calculations that we did, this is equal to this times epsilon. And that's the same whether I use pi prime cuspidal or I have to use these guys here. But by a combination, of the assumed, so this is the third part of being nice, the global functional equation for either LS pi times pi prime or the LS pi times tau I, and the known local functional equations for V and T, we get that I S uxc phi prime is equal to I S vxc phi prime for all phi prime in proper automorphic representations of on GLn minus 1. Okay, and for all C and V prime. All right, so I get equality. And now, here's something to note, and, it's more than that. So I get this equality, so that's a good thing. And it turns out, life is not pleasant sometimes. Let me use this. Okay, doesn't matter. I have to correct a lie. So these two things are equal. They're entire functions of S, and by an application, of the Fragman-Lindelof principle, they're bounded in strips. Okay. Now, if you had done your homework, you haven't done your homework, because if you'd done your homework, you'd have come to me because you probably couldn't do it. Although if you did do your homework, I want to know about it. If you're thinking, you say, well, if I want to know that's bounded in vertical strips, this is assumed to be bounded in vertical strips, and I've told you that these are all bounded in vertical strips. In fact, there was that Archimedean exercise that said, show that these ratios are entire and bound it in vertical strips. Well, the problem is I really don't know how to show they're bounded in vertical strips at the Archimedean place, because I'm dividing by the gamma function, not. So, but even dividing by the gamma function, that's moderate enough growth that lets me use absolute convergence of one thing in a half plane and the other thing in a half plane. And I get this moderate growth in the strip to use Fragman Lindelof to say that these are bounded in vertical strips. But that fact I told you about the Archimedean ratios, I don't know how to do. I mean, it's easy to see they're entire. That's an exercise. But the boundedness in vertical strips I may have overstated. So if you've done it, I'd like to know. But I'm dividing. Yeah. Which is a weak enough growth to apply Fragman Lindelof. Right. Yeah. Right. Right. So that's enough to apply it here. But it's not the exercise that I said I'm not sure that I can do. But it's enough to apply it here. Anyway, these are bounded in vertical strips. Okay. So now here we go. So now I have these two integrals are equal. Right. But they're still, Fragman Lindelof doesn't care how you get the functions. I mean, one of them's bounded. Remember, they converge in different half planes. One of them's fine here. Right. But that gives me something over here. The other one gives me something over here. And all I have to know is that in between, they're reasonable. Okay. And in between, I can use either of these expressions in between. I can use this expression in between, that's bounded in vertical strips, and this is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Can I use that?
No. No, I'm not. I'm using one of them here, the other one here, and that I do know something at least about mild growth in between. No, I'm not using the. No, that's why. That's the Fragman Lindelof part. Okay. So what do we know? So. Here we go. So I know this. In the sense of analytic continuation. Okay? In the sense of analytic continuation. True? In the sense of analytic continuation. In the sense of analytic continuation. Right. No, but I want to write it this way. Okay? Because now I'm going to use that even though this is valid in the sense of analytic continuation, right, as long as they converge in separate half planes, they're equal in the sense of analytic continuation, and these things are bounded in vertical strips. There is a version of Mellin inversion from Jacquet and Langlands that works here. Okay, so I really write this as the Mellin transform of the function where I integrate on SL. And that's a perfectly reasonable function because things are rapidly decreasing. And I write this as a Mellin transform that converges in a different realm of the integral over SL. Which is perfectly reasonable. That's a well-defined thing. Okay. So I now this is where boundedness in vertical strips uses. So using EVS plus the Jacquet-Langlands. I believe all it says is well, let me finish first, and then I can either look it up or try to recall it off the top of my head. But let me go ahead and finish first. Right, but this is, I mean, it's basically a contour shifting argument. Anyway, what it gives is that the integral over SL these are equal. And this is rapidly decreasing. There's no question, there's no problem of convergence here. And there's no problem of convergence here. Mellon inversion is. I mean, it is. I mean, well, no, it's not that non-trivial. No. In some sense.
You could then, I mean, if you look at things as big as a socket, then you lose a lot of integration because you're doing it as this object,
yeah,
which is controlling the entire, you lose a lot of integration. And then in that way,
you can apply it.
Now, this next one, where you have,
I think that's probably the way it's proven. Well,
I mean, one side is valuable. The right hand side is right. You cannot have it equal.
I agree.
But that way it's not going to be.
Okay. That's probably the way that you prove it. But right now, what I'm interested in is sort of showing you what's happening. Okay? I mean, it is true that these are equal in the sense of analytic continuation. That's a true statement. Okay? And Jacquet and Langlands do have a version of Mellon inversion that applies in this situation. And when you apply it, you get that. Okay? And the only reason I wrote this up here is to get... Yes. That's true. Even I could prove that. Yes, I want V on the other side. This is just to give you a sense of how one goes from here to here. Yeah, if you take the Mellon transform of this, so what you really do is we'll let u c of a be this integral. I believe this is the way it works out. U, capital U, c, and then I can just put h a 111. Okay? Let's put the same thing here. Okay? That's uc of A. The Mellon transform of that. And so the determinant to this matrix is just absolute value of A. Right? The Mellon's transform of that converges for the real part of S sufficiently big, and it is this. Okay. And now, if you like, I'm entire, I'm bounded in vertical strips, I can shift my line of integration all the way to the other side. And on the other side, this is the integral of the similar thing with okay. And so all I've written down here is that u c of 1 equals v c of 1. I shift the line of integration. That's where it gets used. Anyway. But now what do I know? Okay, now what do I know? Well, now I'm going to dump into the weak form of Langlands spectral decomposition, because what I know is these two functions, uc and vc, are equal when I integrate them against essentially any cusp form on SLN minus 1 and any Eisenstein series on SLN minus 1. And I know if I'm way out in the realm of absolute convergence, L2 is spanned by wave packets formed from Eisenstein series. So that set of functions, phi prime, that are actually restrictions to SL of these proper automorphic forms on GL, gives me a complete set of functions. Okay, so the weak version of Langlands spectral theory implies that the phi prime are complete, which implies that these two functions are equal for H in SLN minus 1 for all xi. Okay. And in fact, we're going to throw it all away. This just tells me that they agree at the identity. That's a true fact. What I mean is I don't need spectral expansion on the unitary axis. I'm perfectly happy working way out in the realm of absolute convergence and using those Eisenstein series out there or the wave packets formed from those Eisenstein series. Okay? Because that's any proper thing. So that means working way out in the realm of absolute convergence and using those either incomplete theta series or wave packets or whatever you call them out there. And that's what I get out of inverting my integral representation. I don't get that they're equal for all g, but I get they're equal somewhere. So finally, let me finish the complete the proof of the first part of theorem one. Well, the important thing here is this. I've done this for every vector. So, if I want to know what this is at G, well, this was an intertwining. This is the same thing as U of pi G C. And that's just another vector in my representation. Okay. So, at least this maps into the space of automorphic forms. Oops, GLN. So that's true. I also know a little bit more because I still know that this is given by that same Fourier expansion sum. Okay? And what can I say from here? Well, actually, there's two questions. I haven't addressed the cuspidality yet. I just made something that has the right invariance. You can check that it has that it's moderate growth. That's not a problem. So it's an automorphic form. One thing I hadn't checked is that it's not zero. And I haven't checked that it's cuspidal. But it turns out both of those follow from here. If I want to show it's non-zero, let me compute a non-zero Fourier coefficient. I do. I get back the Whitaker function. If it has a non-zero Fourier coefficient, it's non-zero. So it's not zero. It's irreducible, so I now get actually an embedding of my space in the space of automorphic forms. How do I tell if it's cuspidal? Compute unipotent integrals for the unipotent radicals of all maximal parabolics. I compute them using this expression, and they're all zero. So in fact, I use this expression to both show that it's not zero and that it's cuspidal. So non-vanishing and cuspidality follow from this expansion. All right, let me say two words. Is this okay? Let me say two. Well, I never addressed whether that sum vanished or not, I don't think. Well, I mean, if I plugged in the zero function, I haven't done very much. So I really should have addressed the non-vanishing early on in the game. But I didn't. I forgot. Okay, before I end, because if I ended now, I'd end on time, and there's just no point in starting that this late in the game. What messes up here? Where do things break down? Okay. Well, if I run my argument, they break down. Everything is perfectly fine until I get to this weak version of Langlands spectral theory, right? Because I've missed some representations. I can't conclude this. Okay? Because I haven't twisted by, I haven't controlled the twist of the representations that have any ramification at this set S. Okay? So here's what we're going to do. Let me just tell you what we're going to do, and then we'll come back and we'll do it next week. Okay? So what I'm going to do is at the places in S, I am going to take a particular vector in my representation. I'm going to fix C at those places, and I'm going to take the new vector, if you like. Okay? The one that's fixed under this K1 group. And the reason is, that K1 group, right, that's basically things that look like they're congruent to the mirabolic, not in. Those things are going to be unramified when you restrict them to GLN minus 1. So if I restrict the local components to be those vectors at the places in S, the integrals involving representations that are ramified at the places in S are going to be zero. So I'm forcing, by putting local conditions on those places, I force this equality at for the rest of my phi prime because both sides are zero. Okay? And we'll go through the details of this on next week. Then I can run this, and everything's fine, and I get this, except not for my whole representation, because I've fixed my components at a certain number of places. And I somehow have to work around that fact, and we're going to work around that fact using weak approximation. And that use of weak approximation will fill in something at those places, but I don't know what. But it's going to give me something automorphic that's going to have the right properties. I'm not going to have such an expansion anymore. I'm not going to be able to do cuspidality in the same way. But that's what you do here. So it's just you put on some local tricks, some local components to finesse what you missed, and off you go. Okay? Theorem 2 is done the same way. You're missing twist. You put on local conditions that say they don't matter, and then you have to work around it. So that's what we'll do. We'll do second part of this theorem, discuss what you then have to do theorem two, and then talk about the conjectures and what's expected and things like that. And then hopefully there'll be some time to begin discussing functoriality, a little more on functoriality next week. The week after that, there's something in here on the Tuesday. That last Tuesday in April, there's something in here. So that week we're going to meet on Thursday, May the 1st. And so on Thursday, May the 1st, I would like to talk about how you use this to do the liftings from generic cusp forms of classical groups to GLM. So that'll be the last lecture. All right. So anyway, but you have to remember all this stuff because I'm going to tell you how to vary it next time. So, okay.